What's next for migrants at the border? Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Marjorie Castillo is one of thousands of asylum seekers stuck in Tijuana right now. And after the chaos there over the weekend, she's worried.
Me preocupa de que quizás por todo eso, mis oportunidades se vayan abajo.
Worried that her chances of getting to the U.S. just went down. Meanwhile, Mexico's incoming president is negotiating a new migration deal with the Trump administration after suggesting he wouldn't during his campaign.
But obviously, as the dynamics of some of these caravans have played out, the incoming Mexican government has realized that it has a real challenge on its hands.
What Mexico has to gain from a deal with Trump, those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for being here. At the U.S.-Mexico border yesterday, mayhem. Mayhem that shut down the San Ysidro port of entry, the busiest crossing with Mexico. We're going to take some time considering what is next, but we start today with reporter Emily Green. She's been following the migrant caravan for us through Mexico. In Tijuana, she met a woman named Marjorie Castillo. Marjorie's trying to apply for asylum in the U.S., but for the time being, she's with her husband and three daughters, the five of them sleeping in one tent just a few miles from U.S. soil. Emily spoke with Marjorie this morning to find out how she's doing.
And I asked her, what do you think about the events of yesterday, about all of these migrants trying to cross into the United States in one big mass? And this is what she had to tell me.
Pues la verdad que estoy bien molesta, y pienso que son ignorantes porque no piensan en las demás personas, sino que.
So she says to me there, the truth is, I am really annoyed. I think that they're being stupid and sort of and not thinking about other people, that they're only thinking about themselves, because the actions of what they did yesterday in terms of throwing stones and trying to enter illegally, that affects everyone here at the shelter and in Tijuana, not just themselves.
What was Marjorie Castillo's own experience with what happened this weekend? I mean, she didn't try to cross illegally. Where was she? What was she doing?
Right. She said she stayed camped out at the shelter with her children because she was extremely scared of what was going to happen and feared that something of a showdown and tear gas being fired was going to occur. And in fact, she was right.
How was Marjorie Castillo so certain that pandemonium would break out along the border?
She says that in the days leading up to the march on the border, there was talk of everybody going. And I think that in itself sort of scared her that thousands of people would be marching to the border. But she says many of the migrants told her they were going to go with everything they had, ir con todo.
Personas dijeron que iban ir con todo, y con todo es.
And what that meant was throwing rocks, throwing stones, doing whatever they had to get into the U.S. And that kind of talk, she says, scared her.
Did she tell you how she reacted to the U.S. Border Patrol firing tear gas across the border?
She told me she worried that it was going to affect her own chances at asylum.
Me preocupa de que quizás por todo eso, pues mis oportunidades se vayan abajo, pero.
She says, I'm worried that because of the events of Sunday, that that's going to hurt her own slim chances of getting asylum. But she says she is going to wait and she wants to try and get into the United States the correct way.
So is that wishful thinking on her part, that if the situation remains calm, then her chances for asylum go up?
I think that she knows that her chances of asylum are very slim and that they just got slimmer. But she really is kind of between a rock and a hard place. She does not want to return to Honduras. She says her husband there has faced death threats from the gangs. She's made it this far. They've traveled for a month plus. So there's really no turning back, but there's nowhere to go ahead either. And so at this point, they're kind of stuck. They're stuck in this tent and makeshift shelter in Tijuana where there's not enough food and not enough water.
Emily Green telling us about one family of migrants in Tijuana. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to reporter Erin Siegel McIntyre, who's based in Tijuana. I asked her what looks different there today.
So if you're in downtown, if you're anywhere around the ports of entry, there is an immense amount of concertina wire everywhere. That's usually not here. And there is a really heavy police presence all around the city, all across the fence from the very westernmost part in Playas de Tijuana, all the way through downtown, over into La Libertad, which is where some of the attempted breaches happened yesterday. All the way to Otay, there is a much higher number of police.
And what is it like there today?
Things are definitely calmer. As of last night, both directions in the port of entry at San Ysidro were open. But I will say the mood is still fairly tense. Regular Mexicans don't know what's going to happen next. And I think the same actually could be said for a lot of the migrants who are staying in the shelter here.
What are you hearing from the local Mexican residents? And what are you hearing from the migrants about that tension right now?
You know, folks are generally uncomfortable. This month, November, leading up to the holidays, it's a big month for border crossings, right? Folks cross to shop. There are thousands of regular people that commute every day to jobs in the United States and vice versa. So any kind of border closure really affects daily life here. And aside from that, Tijuana continues to struggle with sort of providing the most basic resources for this group of migrants, which is now over 6,000 strong. Folks are also concerned about the cost of, for example, providing even just one meal a day to the folks that are staying in this government-run shelter here.
I'm curious to know how much Mexicans are a little anxious at the moment because there's a new president coming in, next Saturday in Mexico? And
right, that's
policies
correct.
Could and change? I mean, what is that kind of?
Exactly. I mean, there are a lot of rumors around, okay, so what's AMLO going to do? What's going to change? And there's
López
been
Obrador.
A lot of. The incoming president. And there's been a lot of talk about whether or not he's going to sort of accommodate some of the wishes of the Trump administration. And so I think most people are sort of watching with eagle eyes to see what is actually going to happen versus what is being floated as potential ideas for resolving the situation.
Reporter Erin Siegel McIntyre there in Tijuana. Meantime, the Trump administration is trying to find a way out of this. U.S. officials are trying to persuade the incoming Mexican government to accept a deal they're calling Remain in Mexico. It would make migrants stay on the Mexican side of the border and wait until their applications for asylum in the U.S. are approved. Arturo Sarucan was the Mexican ambassador to the U.S. between 2007 and 2013. He's now in Washington. What do you think about this proposal, Ambassador, to force migrants to have their asylum hearings in Mexico?
For starters, we don't know what we don't know. And what I mean by this is that the conversations are apparently going on. The transition team came out this weekend in Mexico. So the Mexican transition team came out in Mexico City this weekend saying that nothing had been agreed to. They even went a step further than that and said that the Remain in Mexico idea has not been approved by the incoming Mexican government. But we do know that there are conversations ongoing. We do know that they have discussed the role that Mexico can, should, wants to play in not only deterring transmigration through Mexico on its way to the United States, but what role it can play to ensure that the border on both sides of the Mexico-U.S. border is secure. So I think we have to wait to see some of those details flushed out. My sense is, Marco, we may not get a lot of that until after December the 1st when the López Obrador administration assumes office.
I mean, the incoming government in Mexico, the government of Andrés Manuel López Obrador, denied that there's an official deal, even though it seemed to confirm it at one point. What do you think that suggests?
It was a sort of non-denial of a denial. They have obviously advanced in some form or another. Now, Marco, this is a hard place for the incoming Mexican government to be. For starters, because throughout the campaign, López Obrador said basically that he wouldn't do Trump's dirty work when it came to stopping Central American transmigration. But obviously, as the dynamics of some of these caravans have played out in the past days and weeks, the incoming Mexican government has realized that it has a real challenge on its hands, not only in terms of securing Mexico's own borders, but in designing its own paradigm of what it wants its own migration policy to look like, regardless of what the Trump administration wants. And more importantly, from those of us, including myself, who argue that if we're going to do something akin to supporting the Remain in Mexico program, if that is what evolves from the ongoing conversations, that Mexico, A, shouldn't be doing it to appease the Trump administration, and B, should be doing it as part of a quid pro quo agreement. That is, that if Mexico does host Central American migrants that have a bona fide case of refugee or asylum hearings in the U.S., that this be done in exchange for something that's important for Mexico. And that's where I think maybe, just maybe, by the fact that the Trump administration has significantly reduced international aid to the three Central American countries of Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, that this idea that López Obrador has articulated throughout his campaign of a sort of Marshall Plan, quote unquote, in which the U.S. and Mexico and maybe others would invest in sustainable economic development in the three Northern Triangle countries of El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala.
I mean, violence reduction is a great thought, but that's precisely what the Trump administration is cutting back on, those resources right now.
Exactly. That's why many of us have questioned whether it is realistic to think that the Trump administration will put significant political and financial capital and diplomatic capital into a holistic, sustainable development program for those three Central American nations, given that they have been reducing those budgets in the past year and a half for the State Department.
I mean, whatever you may believe is a holistic approach, there are a lot of Trump supporters in the White House itself that see the Remain in Mexico plan as shared responsibility.
Absolutely. I don't doubt that. And they see this as a very important tool in a deterrence-driven migration policy, which I think is a mistake. The only way Mexico and others are going to address the structural causes for migration are attacking issues like the weakness of the rule of law in those Central American countries, creating sustainable economic opportunities, understanding the impact that climate change is having in certain areas of Central America that explain some of the rural economic-driven migration that we're seeing through Mexico. Now, the problem, again, is how this is articulated, whether it's done because the Trump administration has held or is holding a gun to the head of the incoming Mexican administration.
Does Mexico have detention facilities along the border?
Not enough to house the sizable numbers of Central American migrants that are there now and that may continue to come.
Mm. So they'd have to improvise the way they're doing with the sports complex.
With stadiums and gymnasiums and some of the churches that have played a very important role in housing some of these Central American migrants. Absolutely.
Ambassador, do you know what the reaction has been among Mexicans more widely to the possibility of this new migration agreement?
Given that there's little detail yet, I think most of the reactions have been muted so far. But there is, Marco, a generalized sense in Mexico, across the public opinion, that Mexico, given the current circumstances of the relationship with the United States under the Trump administration, should be in no mood to extend favors to this administration. And there is a generalized sense that we shouldn't be doing the United States' work in filtering Central American migrants. At the same time, because of some of the pressures that we've seen on TV, in newsprint, about how local and state authorities are having a hard time coping with some of the effects of these caravans, there are some voices, some of them, no surprise here, being agitated by trolls and bot farms on social media, who have voiced concern about the impact that these migrants have on the well-being of Mexican cities, particularly per what you've seen in Tijuana.
Arturo Sarucan, the former Mexican ambassador to the U.S. Ambassador, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Marco. Great to be with you again.
Tensions flare again between Russia and Ukraine. That story is up next, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The conflict between Russia and Ukraine has been on a slow burn for the last couple of years. That is, until yesterday. Russian warplanes and ships attacked and seized three ships of Ukraine's navy after they approached waters claimed by Russia. In response, Ukraine's government is declaring martial law in border regions. Sunday's clash took place in a vital seaway called the Kerch Strait. Alina Polyakova is a fellow at the Brookings Institution.
The Kerch Strait has been an issue of serious contention ever since Russia's illegal annexation and continued occupation of Crimea in 2014, because it is a body of water through which Ukrainian, Russian, and other ships have to pass to get, for example, let's say from Istanbul, if you want to make a shipment directly to a port in southeastern Ukraine, you have to pass through the Kerch Strait. And it's a relatively narrow passageway, so it is, you know, very ripe for potential accidents, for conflict. So it is a significant commercial passageway that is critical to the Ukrainian economy.
I mean, it's not far from where the fighting has been happening since 2014. How is this event in the Kerch Strait and the fighting in eastern Ukraine, how are they connected?
Since Russia took control of Crimea, the Russian government, to much fanfare, has now built a bridge that connects mainland Russia over the Kerch Strait to Crimea, which allows Russia to supply Crimea with food and other resources. What's been happening on land, on Ukrainian land territory, not in the maritime territory, is that Russia has seemed to desire to have a land bridge all the way to Crimea, because even with the construction of this new bridge that does connect Russia to Crimea, it is still difficult to get other things like electricity and water to Crimea, and it is costing the Russian Federation quite a bit of money to continue have to go over this bridge and to use waterways especially. So it's a potential strategy on the Russian side to try to put more pressure on Mariupol especially, so they can over time even take over that land territory and have access to Crimea via land versus via water.
Isn't that totally illegal?
Yes. Yes.
I'm glad we cleared that up. What is your sense of who actually started this?
Well, we know that it's a typical Russian strategy, not just in the Ukraine conflict, but also going all the way back to 2008 with the Russian war with Georgia. It's to provoke with an initial aggressive move that seems relatively minor, ramming a small Ukrainian tugboat, for example, which is what happened in the last few days. And then any sort of response from the other side is then used as an excuse to commence much more direct military aggression. And this is exactly the kind of pattern that we're seeing develop today with this escalation in the Azov Sea and the Kerch Strait. So this is part of the Kremlin's playbook. We've seen this movie before. I think the big question now is, will the international community respond in a much more assertive way than we've seen back, let's say, in 2008 with the Russian war in Georgia?
So do you see this turning into a war? And would it be a clash between the actual armed forces of both Russia and Ukraine?
The potential for a full-out war of that nature is unlikely. First of all, the Ukrainians are no match for Russian naval military might in the Sea of Azov. They're completely outflanked and outmatched. And then on the Russian side, there is also not much of an incentive to have a full blown out war, which could potentially involve other world powers like the United States or even Europe. And that's not something that the Russian people would want. I don't think that's something that the Russian leadership would want. I think what is much more likely is that we're going to see this slow burning, continued aggression that we've been seeing on land in Ukraine now happening in the sea.
Last thing, I'm just curious to know, Alina, what you think, whether Putin felt kind of substantially emboldened by Trump's kind of whatever response to what happened to Jamal Khashoggi.
That's an interesting question. I think certainly President Trump's stated desire to stand by Saudi Arabia in light of this quite brutal murder has sent a signal to Putin that President Trump will likely stand by him as well. I hope that is not true. I hope that there is a line that the Russians are not allowed to cross. And I think certainly the U.S. Congress should use this as an opportunity to impose consequences on Russia, to make it very clear that the U.S. continues to recognize Ukrainian sovereignty and will not recognize Russia's continued aggression against independent states.
Alina Polyakova at the Brookings Institution, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
On my way home, I see that billboard and I want to eat that cheeseburger on it now. Willpower, not going to bite. But according to the Centers for Disease Control, 40% of Americans on any given day are eating fast food. Not only that, they're consuming way too much sugar and not enough fruits or veggies. In the UK, same problem. But now London's Mayor Sadiq Khan has announced that ads for junk food will be banned in trains and subways and buses. And there's widespread backing for the move. Kate Oglesby is a reporter for the BBC. So why are these efforts, pretty big efforts, being made to remove junk food ads?
So the efforts come from the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan. It's part of his strategy to tackle childhood obesity in the capital, London. Nearly 40% of children in London are overweight, which is actually the highest in any city in Europe. If you get on the tube, then there's fast food adverts everywhere. And actually, research from Cancer Research shows that people bombarded, or young people bombarded with adverts for fast food, are more likely to be obese.
And why do you think it got so much support? I mean, what are people saying?
I think obesity is quite high in London. I mean, just to break the figures down, 23.6% of 10 to 11-year-olds are severely overweight. I think there's a massive public health crisis. You know, people are sort of looking for a solution to reduce this obesity. And that's just a great way of doing it, because Transport for London and undergrounds take up so much room in the capital.
What about food programs in schools? How widely are they available, and what do you find being fed to the students?
So a few years ago, there was a big debate over school meals, and famous chef Jamie Oliver actually worked hard to sort of take out of a lot of junk food from school meals. So that's highly improving, but I think there's a focus on like teaching children in schools now how to eat healthily. So a lot more focus on the education programs as well as what they're fed in schools.
And what is the assessment so far, that things are improving or that there's still a very long way to go?
I think the assessment is that things have improved a lot so far. But I think if you look at the measures that have sort of been brought in, particularly within the capital, then it would suggest there is a lot more to go. There's sort of a lot of focus on children and young people. And obviously obesity levels are still very high. Still 40% of children in London are overweight.
My colleague at the BBC, reporter Kate Oglesby, thanks for your time.
Great. Thank you. Bye.
I'm Marco Werman. That climate report the government released the day after Thanksgiving, you really need to know about it.
So often we feel like it only really matters to the polar bears or maybe future generations. But this report talks about what is changing and how that is affecting real people today in every part of the United States.
That's just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. If you're not outraged, as they say, you're not paying attention. Or maybe it was Black Friday. 3 days ago, on a day most Americans were not paying attention to the news, the U.S. government dropped a staggering report on climate change. Today, President Trump was asked about the report.
I've seen it. I've read some of it, and it's fine.
Trump also offered this verdict on the report's dire predictions for the long-term effects of climate change.
Yeah, I don't believe it. No, I don't believe it.
One of the report's authors has a very different view.
This report brings the issue of climate change home to the places where we live. So often we feel like it only really matters to the polar bears or maybe future generations. But this report talks about what is changing and how that is affecting real people today and how we're responding, which is, you know, we are responding, but not enough. And what are the bigger changes that we need to make in order to ensure that we're all going to be okay in the future?
That's Catherine Hayhoe, director of the Climate Science Center at Texas Tech. She's the lead author on one of the chapters of the report. And as she told me, its release during a holiday weekend is also noteworthy.
That's a decision that's made way over our heads. As authors, we're just told, here's when it's coming out. And in the case of last Friday, we only got that news a very short time ahead of time. The fact that it came out on Black Friday, though, I think is actually really appropriate. In fact, many of us are already starting to call this the Black Friday report, because that's what it's telling us. It's telling us that, unfortunately, this is not good news.
I mean, symbolically, it is eerie that this report should come out on Black Friday of all days. But I mean, you've seen some of the comments from Trump's advisors who said, yeah, release the report without revisions. We'll put it out on Black Friday, basically saying, we don't deny this. We just don't care. Am I getting that wrong?
When we listen to what the administration says, it doesn't give us a lot of hope. This report flatly contradicts pretty much every statement they've made, from the idea that one cold day somehow disproves decades of global warming to the idea that the Paris Agreement will cost the United States more than it will benefit.
I mean, what do you think this says about the Trump administration's policies on the climate going forward?
It's a very short-sighted perspective. The White House is doing the equivalent of 100 years ago, pouring money into and investing in horses and buggies when Henry Ford is already turning out the Model T Ford. The tide really is turning, and trying to hold back the tide to satisfy a few special interest groups instead of making meaningful changes, such as investing in job development and retraining programs for coal miners to help them switch jobs, support their families, and continue to work. It's a crying shame that Chinese companies are coming into Wyoming and doing this on their own initiative, taking coal miners and retraining them to do wind power installations. Why can't the U.S. government do the same for its own people?
Well, I'm just about to ask you that. I mean, will this report, backed by 13 federal agencies, as you point out, is it going to strengthen the legal arguments against the administration's efforts to gut federal climate policies? Or do you think it might trigger stronger action among state and local governments, which is already a trend?
Well, I definitely hope it will do the latter, and I suspect it will also contribute to the former, because we are seeing an increasing number of lawsuits related to climate change, whether it's individual states or cities like California or Boulder suing companies that produce fossil fuels because of the impact on their coasts, on their infrastructure, on their water resources, or whether it's children suing the federal government for their right to a safe future. So the conversation is already happening across the whole U.S., whether you're talking about corn producers, ranchers, water managers, transportation engineers, individual cities and states, regions, tribal nations. The conversation is happening, it seems like to me, almost everywhere except the federal government.
Catherine Hayhoe, the director of the Climate Science Center at Texas Tech University. She's also the author of one chapter in the Fourth National Climate Assessment, which came out last Friday. Catherine, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
If you're looking for places where the effects of climate change are already being felt, check out the Arctic. The region is warming up and fast. At the same time, Russia is flexing its muscle there. But like a lot of things Russian, it's hard to know what's actually going on in that part of the Arctic. Reporter Amy Martin of the Threshold podcast spent some time with a Norwegian journalist whose work in Russia got him kicked out of the country.
Russia has more land in the Arctic than any other country. The easternmost point is well east of Japan. 11 time zones to the west, the country borders Norway, where Thomas Nilsen lives and works as a reporter in the town of Kirkenes. He's been crossing back and forth between Norway and Russia for decades.
Yeah, I've been more or less traveling in the northern part of Russia for the last 30 years.
Thomas is the editor of the Barents Observer, an online newspaper that covers northern Scandinavia and northwest Russia, the area bordering the Barents Sea. This part of the world is being transformed by climate change, and if you want to understand some of the crucial changes and challenges at play here, you have to know what's going on in Russia.
We have to remember that half of the Arctic is Russia, and half of Russia is Arctic, the majority of the population living in the circumpolar Arctic actually are on the Russian side of the border.
As the climate warms, the Russian Arctic is becoming more accessible, and that means resource development in the area is heating up too. Here's just a small sample. The world's biggest liquefied natural gas plant is in north-central Siberia, threatening the future of the Nenets, an indigenous reindeer herding culture. There are huge oil and gas projects in the eastern part of the country too, plus offshore drilling in the Arctic Ocean. And some of the biggest companies in the Russian Arctic are also some of the region's worst polluters. Then there's thawing permafrost, sea ice loss, deforestation, the list goes on and on. If you've heard about something happening with climate change elsewhere in the Arctic, it's happening in Russia too. In fact, in true Russian style, these stories are often bigger and more dramatic there than anywhere else. But we almost never hear about them. The Russian Arctic is a place that needs a lot more journalists asking a lot more questions. It's a place that needs Thomas Nilsen.
we can help the rest of the world understand what's happening up here by our reporting. To go to the oil field or out to the areas and talk to the people living on the countryside, the indigenous peoples on the tundra.
Thomas has devoted much of his life to that kind of reporting, but he says he's not going back to Russia anytime soon.
I would love to go back to Russia tomorrow morning, but we had a situation a year ago in March 2017 when I was on one of my ordinary entries into Russia, this time with a delegation from the Danish parliament, but then stopped at the border, brought into a back room with a lot of officers who very politely but told me that I'm no longer wanted in Russia.
He was told he posed a threat to Russia's national security, but exactly what that threat was a complete mystery to Thomas.
It was just a message coming up on the passport control computer when I tried to enter. So I had to hitchhike back to the Norwegian side of the border and has not been in Russia since then.
You must have been shocked.
Yes, I was surprised. I didn't expect that. I have all my papers in order, my journalist visa, my accreditation to work as a reporter in Russia. Not even got a speeding ticket in Russia over these 30 years.
A few days later, the Russian embassy in Oslo issued a press release saying Thomas was on the so-called stop list, meaning he was no longer welcome in Russia. But they still weren't saying why.
I haven't violated any visa regulations or any other Russian laws or regulations. So I'm taking FSB to court, trying to find out why I'm denied entry to Russia, and secondly, to get back my right to do my job as a journalist on Russian territory.
The FSB is the Russian Federal Security Service. Much like its Soviet predecessor, the KGB, it has a shocking amount of power, and it operates mostly in secret. Just figuring out that the FSB was responsible for his expulsion took 3 court cases. But eventually, with help from a lawyer in Moscow, Thomas's case got a hearing. Of course, he wasn't allowed to be there for any of it, since he was banned from the country.
The judge did a good job. They listened to both parties' arguments and so on. But then came the surprise. The ruling by the court was kept secret. The arguments and the reasons why I'm not allowed to enter Russia is kept secret. And that is a clear violation of the Russian constitution.
Thomas appealed the ruling all the way to the Russian Supreme Court, but the court ruled for the FSB. It said Thomas does pose a threat to Russia, and the FSB doesn't have to reveal what that threat is. But he's not stopping. He's taking his case to the European Court of Human Rights. So, what is this all about? Thomas has a hunch.
Every society that have leaders who are on the paths of totalitarian systems are afraid of the freedom of speech. They are afraid of free journalism. So I think that the main reason why the media in Russia and also the Barnes Observer here covering cross-border issues with Russia is under attack is because they are afraid.
They could be afraid because there's a lot for people to be angry about in the Russian Arctic. For instance, waste from a nickel mining company has heavily contaminated more than 1,000 square miles of forest in Siberia. An outside watchdog group has twice listed the area as one of the top 10 most polluted places in the world. And just across the border from Norway, near Murmansk, one recent study found dangerously high levels of heavy metals in people. Almost all of the big companies moving into the Russian Arctic have close ties to the Putin regime, and they don't take kindly to reporters trying to hold them accountable, especially reporters who are attempting to inform Russians. Some outside journalists still travel throughout Russia and report on corruption and repression, but the Barents Observer is one of the very few that publishes in Russian, with the express intention of trying to provide independent journalism to the Russian people themselves.
We are the only newspaper in northern Scandinavia that is publishing in Russian language. And we have thousands of readers on the Russian side of the border.
And even though the Barents Observer is tiny, they have a full-time staff of 2, Thomas says this wasn't the first time they've been harassed. In 2014, officials accused the Observer of being a mouthpiece for the Norwegian government. And that same year, the FSB directly requested that Norwegian officials close the paper down.
These Norwegian officials responded, that's not the way it works in Norway. We have the media freedom and authorities never interfere.
For Thomas, this fight is about a lot more than his own freedom to report in Russia. President Vladimir Putin began cracking down on independent journalism almost immediately after being elected in 2000. And ever since, reporters who write critical stories have a tendency to die under mysterious circumstances. A few months ago, three Russian journalists were murdered, and when an activist tried to investigate their deaths and potential Kremlin connections, he was poisoned, but survived. The Committee to Protect Journalists lists Russia as number 11 on its Global Impunity Index, meaning when Russian journalists are killed or attacked, it's rare for anyone to be held accountable. All of this violence and intimidation of the media has huge implications for Russians, first and foremost, but Thomas says it also matters to anyone who wants to try to understand the Russian Arctic. He says the media is needed to serve its traditional role here, ferreting out corruption and highlighting voices that would otherwise get drowned out.
What do we lose by not knowing more? Like, how can that affect, I don't know, decision-making, policy, international relations, by just not having the information?
I think the most untold stories are the consequences for the locals living in areas where big oil is moving in, or where the military start to rebuild their facilities and so on. So the media's role of being the voice of, like, indigenous reindeer herders, mm-hmm. that is what I'm most scared that we are lacking.
They could just get kind of wiped off the map and we would never really...
We will most likely not realize it before it's too late for many of them. And that is what journalism is all about. It's about being inside and being able to see a story from different perspectives. Mm-hmm. And that is more difficult to do today in northern Russia.
Are you feeling like there's hope? Do you have hope for the Arctic?
The day we lose the hope, then it's a kind of game over. So, of course, we do have hope.
As a symbol of their hope and determination, the Barents Observer has this Russian toy in their offices, a plastic doll with huge green eyes and a round red body. If you try to knock it down, it bobs back up.
It's called a nevalyashka. It means that you cannot tip it over. It will always rise again.
Thomas Nilsson and his colleagues in Kirkenes have stuck a sign on the belly of the doll that says, "Try to tip over freedom of expression and see what happens."
So you can try to tip over free journalism, but we will always come up again.
For The World, I'm Amy Martin, Kirkenes, Norway.
Amy's reporting on climate change in the Arctic comes to us through our partnership with the Threshold podcast and with funding support from the Pulitzer Center. From Iceland and Sweden to Russia and Alaska, over the past few weeks, we've been bringing you stories from the Arctic and the people who live there. Check out our Instagram for a recap of some of the stories and to test your knowledge with our Arctic quiz. We are at PRI The World on Instagram. It is always an unsettling feeling when someone you interviewed in a war zone actually dies. Syrian opposition activist Raed Feres was killed in the same place I spoke with him from 4 years ago, the area of Idlib. When we spoke, his village, Kafran Bel, was being targeted by Syrian government forces, but also by U.S. airstrikes aimed at ISIS. When I asked him what it was like living there, here's what he told me.
For me, I have here like a generator, a big generator. But in general, you can't find internet or cell phones or telephones. You can't find anything. We have walkie-talkies here, but not a lot. We got some radios. They charge like in a handle. It's a very small one, but they can hear us. Mm. And we warn them, and then they can protect themselves. We live like cavemen without electricity.
And that's where the Skype line cut off. It was the only time I spoke with Feres. Late last week, we got the news that he was killed. Here's Rebecca Collard with his story.
In 2011, like so many Syrians, Raed Feres took to the streets to protest against the government of Bashar al-Assad. And when those protests turned into war, Feres documented human rights violations by the government and the devastation caused by airstrikes and shelling, sharing it with the world in videos like this one. Feres walks through the aftermath of a strike on his village, Kafran Bel. Smoke rises above buildings, and rescue workers pull people from the rubble.
بس اللي كان مستحيل انه يكون فيني اوصلكم.
What it's impossible for me to show you, Farris told an audience last year at the Oslo Freedom Forum, is what you smell when you reach a place like this. The smell of burnt blood, the smell of burnt vegetables, the smell of body parts, the smell of gunpowder. Farris's resistance started against the Assad government, but as militants took over opposition-held parts of Syria, he held them to account too. He posted videos putting Kafran Bell on the international stage. Each week, residents would hold signs in English, often with satirical messages. In this video from 2015, residents held signs in English. One read, Black Friday special offer. Bring your enemy and come fight in Syria for free.
أسعد الله أوقاتكم مستمعينا بكل خير إلى حضراتكم مجزة لأهم الأنباء من راديو فريش.
In 2013, Farris launched Radio Fresh. It broadcast news and warned residents of air raids, and it put Farris in the crosshairs of the government and the extremist factions among Syria's opposition. When U.S. funding for Radio Fresh was stopped as part of aid cuts to Syria's opposition, Farris wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post. He warned that without voices like Radio Fresh to provide alternative messages, another generation would take up arms and create new editions of ISIS.
Farris, اللي أنا بعرفه والكل بيعرفه.
Ahmed Al-Hamdou was a friend and colleague of Farris's at Radio Fresh. Hamdou says he told Farris to leave Syria, that it wasn't safe, but Farris refused.
لا تأخذني بس لسه ما تعلمت أردف في كلمة شهيد. لأنه خسارته كبيرة بالنسبة لنا كان جبل.
I still can't get used to saying the martyr, Ra'id. I'm still trying to absorb the fact that he's gone. He was like a steady mountain. His loss is a catastrophe, and its effect on us is huge.
Farris didn't die in an airstrike or shelling by the Syrian government. He was gunned down in Kafran Bel along with his colleague, Hamoud Junaid. It was not the first attempt on his life. In 2014, he almost died after being shot in the chest by ISIS militants. Nobody knows for sure who sent the gunmen who killed Farris and Junaid. No group has claimed responsibility. But his friends and colleagues say they believe it was jihadist militants that also oppose the Assad government.
We want justice. We reject all those military factions and want a free Syria for all Syrians. These are some of the principles that Ra'id had taught to us, and they can't take his principles away, even though they managed to take his life.
When he spoke in Oslo last year, Farris talked about the double oppression of Syrians.
والحقيقة أنه اللي حصل هو الشعب السوري اللي هو ضحية الإرهابين.
The truth is, he told the audience, the Syrian people are victims of two kinds of terrorism, one led by Assad and one led by ISIS and extremist groups. Farris's death shows the sad reality for the once hopeful revolutionaries and the regular Syrians who simply sought freedom. They are now stuck between the oppressive rule of the Syrian government and the many extremist groups on the ground who also seem uninterested in democracy or freedom for the Syrian people. For the world, Rebecca Collard, Beirut.
Leonard Bernstein once famously said, "This will be our reply to violence, to make music more intensely, more beautifully, more devotedly than ever before." So on this Mood Music Monday, we have this well-timed request. Carrie Eggdell, who listens to us on KQED in San Francisco, made this Mood Music request. It's the Adagio by Tommaso Albinoni. And if you know classical music, you know this is where a controversy comes in. Albinoni, it turns out, did not compose the Adagio in A minor. His biographer, Remo Giazzotto, composed it in the 20th century, claiming he based it on a fragment of a composition by the 18th century master. Historians are still debating how much of this work was Albinoni's. Whatever the truth is, Carrie Eggdell says for him, this is the most heart-wrenchingly sad piece I've ever heard. beginning in melancholia, slowly crescendoing to hope, only to sink during the last few minutes into total despair. Anyway, today we're going to focus on the hopeful part, Carrie. Why? Well, because of you and why you said you're requesting this. The adagio lifts my soul above it all, you wrote, and reminds me there is joy even in the midst of despair. Yes, even in the midst of despair, Albinoni helps. Thank you, Carrie Eggdell, for this week's World Mood Music. And what's your mood music request? You know how this goes. Tell us what your mood is and what song captures that mood, or what song you find that adjusts your mood lately. Tweet it to me, I'm at Marco Werman, or tweet it at the show, we are at PRI The World. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.